From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Grelott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. On Tuesday, President Obama reiterated that the U.S. has evidence chemical weapons have been used in Syria.
I've got to make sure I've got the facts. That's what the American people would expect.
We'll talk about game changers and crossing red lines with our regular contributor and one of this country's preeminent Syria analysts, Joshua Landis.
Obama has used the fact that we don't really know in order to kick the can down the road a little bit.
And later, I'll discuss the education system in Chile with Mario Weissbluth.
Since they are 36 months old, their future is already cast.
He founded Educación 2020, a movement working to improve primary and secondary education in Chile. But first, this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelott. Joshua Landis, Rebecca Cruz, welcome back. We are going to take advantage of your presence today and talk about Syria. It's been a while.
Topic.
It's been a while since we've had an update on Syria. And boy, there's a lot to discuss. I mean, where are we right now? We know that, or do we know that the Syrians have used chemical weapons? Are there markers there? What do we know about that?
There's one major incident outside of Aleppo, the northern city, a small town. Some kind of chemical was used, frothing at the mouth, so forth. There seems to be fairly a growing consensus that sarin gas was used. 10 people died. Does this cross the red line?
That's who used them?
Question.
Do we know who used them? Are we pretty
positive,
sure that it was the regime that used them?
We're not positive, but it would seem safe to say. The trouble is, Obama has used the fact that we don't really know in order to kick the can down the road a little bit. Because he does not want to get involved and drag America into an invasion of Syria. Because in order to get chemical weapons out of Syria, we don't know exactly where they are. They're scattered around the country in air bases. So to send men in white suits into Syria to sort of knock on doors and say, where are the chemical weapons? We need to gather them. You would need to take out first their air power. That would require destroying much of the Syrian military as well as their air force in order that our troops can wander around Syria looking for chemical weapons and taking it out of their bases. So then you get in. And then once you've destroyed the Syrian military, you're in Iraq in a sense because
– it's Iraq all over again.
There's no state. And what happens when chaos breaks out and people begin stripping out copper wire from every office and so forth and looting? We were criticized in Iraq because we only had 100,000 troops to protect an entire country. In Syria, it just opens up the doors. Now, what is going on in Syria is a tragedy. The government is brutal. This is a sectarian civil war. And increasingly, Islamist forces are gaining the upper ground amongst the rebels. The fighters.
So meaning the Islamists are gaining ground. So of all the rebel fighters, so tell us, who are these people, the rebel fighters? This is not a consolidated group.
No.
And you say Islamists are getting the upper hand here, meaning that what exactly
there
could
are
happen?
over 1,000 militias by most estimates operating in Syria. That's because as this revolt has gained ground and the government has lost big hunks of the country, every neighborhood is putting together a militia because there's no law. So somebody goes out with his brothers and his cousins and gets guns and tries to advertise himself as a militia and raises money. This is a free enterprise situation where Gulfies from Saudi Arabia, Qatar, other places, Islamic countries around the world are donating money. And sending in arms. And every little militia that announces itself of 20 guys or 30 guys uploads YouTube videos of them blowing things up and says, send in money. They put a little donate tab on the side of their video and says, we're going to take down this regime. This is jihad. Send in money.
And this is working for them.
It's working. And there is money coming in from donations of all kinds. And so militias are forming. They're raising money through this because the Gulf Sunni countries want to see this Shiite government that's allied with Iran taken down. So there are many countries with a strategic interest in overturning this government.
And they're just arming and funding everyone possible that they can find.
Well, there are all kinds of different people who have different interests.
And exactly. So they're finding anybody and they're arming them and funding them to fight the regime, because that's the goal, is to get rid of the regime. But then what?
Well, that's the problem. And in the north and east of the country, where the government no longer holds sway, we have widespread looting, warlordism. Different militia leaders need to pay their men, and they don't have money. So they put up roadblocks, then they start levying money from people. There's been tons of kidnapping. All kinds of people, especially the wealthy, have been kidnapped. Factories have been stripped, and the stuff has been sold off in order to raise money. So this is, you know, this is L.A. riots gone berserk. I mean, unfortunately, that's the situation. You don't have a central government, and that's the worst of all worlds in many ways. Now, part of the reason there isn't a central government is because the civil war is ongoing. So a lot of rebel leaders say the West should really just arm us up so we can take out this government, because then we can get to the next stage.
How do we know who to arm, though, Joshua? I think that's the bigger issue. If we have all these different groups and we are talking, you know, Obama is at least considering arming the rebels, which rebels?
Well, that's the – there are people who've been talking with America and that's been working with the CIA for well over a year. And there is a Syrian opposition coalition that's put together in Doha with American help and a high military command. The trouble is the leader of this high military command, General Idris, that – John Kerry, Secretary of State, have met, and others. They don't really command troops. They want money and arms so they can buy the loyalty of various militias. That's what they've been doing. So it's a rent-a-militia situation. And you're not getting loyalty. This isn't about an ideology. This is about patronage. And that's what America has done in Afghanistan and Iraq. It's about bringing in money, buying patronage. The trouble is, as soon as you leave,
well, it's like the worst of all possible outcomes.
It's spending tons of money, and you know, according to
tons of money and
leaving weapons
and leaving weapons behind, and not knowing the heck is going to happen afterwards. I mean, we keep waiting for the good news here. I mean,
it's difficult. This is a country in the midst of a civil war, and Syria was patched together by the French, drawn borders around people who didn't want to live together, and the world just expected them to get along. Well, lo and behold, they're not getting along, and they're in a desperate fight, which is a zero-sum game for whoever the losers are going to be. So America wants to get in there and say, hold on, we're going to have a power sharing and set up. In order to stop this, you need to find a way forward. And in Yugoslavia, we divided the country into five or so different states. I mean, you can tell me better than – but the answer was division. In the American Civil War.
It was shared governance. I mean, you're talking about Bosnia, basically, where you have shared governance in Bosnia between the different parties.
But you've got a Croatia. You've got Slovenia.
Yeah, but those are separate countries. Country of Bosnia
was divided into all these separate countries.
Because they declared, themselves.
They divided. They declared independence, yeah.
They did. But America and Europe swept in and confirmed that and didn't let one militia try to conquer them all.
So they should just fight it out. You should just have a winner like you do, you know, boxing match.
The American Civil War was won that way, right? You know, there was a long march to the sea and 750,000 Americans were killed. Okay,
but the longer
much higher kill rate.
But the longer that this takes, the harder it's going to be, right, to ultimately resolve this conflict, right? The longer it takes, the more death, destruction, resentment, hatred. I mean, is it not worthwhile to just go in there and fix it?
Well, if you could fix it, it would be worthwhile. Of course, it depends on the price tag.
Fix it sooner than later.
Well, and it's expanding. We know now that the refugee camps, where there's over 25% of the population has left Syria, they're in most of them in these camps,
right.
And we're seeing uprisings there as well. So it is growing beyond Syria, and the concerns continue.
You know, all the others on their borders that are now feeling the effects.
That's the downside, is that this could ignite conflict in other lands. And the trouble is, this conflict has taken on a religious war. I mean, it's becoming Shiites against Sunnis. And for America to get into the middle of a religious war in the Middle East, we don't want to be the leader. We want to have regional powers sorting this out. We can come in behind them, but if we are holding the whole bag, it's expensive and we haven't had great success.
Absolutely. Well, Joshua, thank you for your discussion about this important topic that we continue to watch.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being with you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this show and answer any questions you may have. Send us a tweet at WorldviewsKGOU or write to us by email at worldviews@ou.edu. You can also leave a comment about this conversation on our website, kgou.org, or on the station's Facebook page. Just search for KGOU. Coming up, I'll discuss socioeconomic segregation in Chile's schools with Mario Weissbluth, the founder of the non-governmental organization Educación 2020. Mario Weissbluth, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So you're doing some very interesting work in Chile on the education system. Can you tell us, first of all, what it is about the Chilean education system that is of concern?
Well, Chile is a very paradoxical country, and we have to distinguish high school and primary school education from university because they are two separate worlds, okay? Maybe I should start by saying that Chile has probably the most neoliberal policies in the whole world. I mean, this is not a joke. Probably the U.S. would be considered socialist compared with Chile, okay, in everything, in education, in health, in pensions, in taxes, and whatever, okay?
So it's a highly privatized society in terms
completely.
Of it. Completely,
and,
okay.
And your well-being depends on yourself. That's okay. Essentially the point, okay?
No public
or there is a very, very, very,
very minimal.
Weak public sector okay. to care for the poorest, okay? The result of that in schools is that can be described by the rule of the 40%, okay? Less than 40% of preschool children go to preschool, especially the poor ones. Mm-hmm. 40% of the kids that come out of basic school don't understand what they read. That's mostly the poor. 40% of the kids that go out to university don't understand what they read. And they are grabbed by a university sector completely and fully deregulated for profit, which abuses them to the point that we've had the explosions that we've had. Well, in that context, our movement, it's a citizens' movement. It was born 4 years ago. It's a long story. It was born almost by serendipity. But today we have 83,000 formal affiliates, 120 followers in Twitter and so many in Facebook. We have the presence in the media once a day on the average. We have presence in Congress. We have been invited. We're permanent guests of the sessions of Congress related to education. And so how do you build in 4 years a movement which has become so influential that we have been able to pass laws through Parliament, increase budgets in some areas, and also stop some laws that we don't think that were quite appropriate?
My guest is Mario Weissbluth, an industrial engineering professor at Universidad de Chile and the founder of Educación 2020. We'll talk more right after this short break. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews on KGOU. I'm Suzette Grelot, the dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. My guest today is Mario Weissbluth. Just before the break, he discussed how his non-governmental organization, Educación 2020, has influenced legislation and education budget negotiations in Chile's parliament. So the goal of your organization, then, is to enhance the quality of education being provided
to the public? It's actually four goals. One is enhance the average quality. That means that the overall average goes up, okay? We are still far, far away from the U.S. or other advanced countries in the world, although Chile is probably on the average the best in Latin America. But more than average quality, it's the problem of equality. There is a big, huge distance between the results that rich kids obtain compared with poor kids.
Okay? So better access for those that
it's
are
not
poor.
Not a problem of access. Everyone goes to school.
So yeah. It's not access. It's
not
a matter
access.
Of just the actual quality.
The quality.
Okay.
That's the second one. The third one is segregation, social segregation of the school system. We have truly what I call an apartheid in education in Chile. The children of the ultra-rich study with the children of the ultra-rich, the children of the rich with the rich, and so forth down the ladder. And in that situation, it's almost impossible that the poor kids will come out of their situation. They are marked. We have longitudinal studies, and they are marked since they are 36 months old. Their future is already cast. So the third area is segregation or desegregation of education in Chile. And the fourth is that public education in Chile has been plummeting as a result of specific policies, okay? This policy of privatization, to give you an idea, today in the U.S., 90% of schools, even with charter schools working, 90% are public. In Chile, they were 80% 20 years ago. Today it's 35%. So we want to recover public education. That's our fourth goal.
So you've been running this organization now for 4 years. You obviously have a significant presence now at this point. So what are some of the successes that you can report? I mean, are you starting to get the word out about this? Are you seeing any changes?
Right. We have obtained very specific things so far. First, directors of schools, the headmasters in schools, in public schools in Chile, were, you won't believe me this, appointees by Pinochet in in 1990. They were in their posts 15 years later. So we have achieved that now headmasters have to be appointed by a contest and with better salaries, because we know, as in all the world, that the headmaster is a very important part of the situation of a school. That's our main, so far, one of our mains. Second is that we have achieved to infuse within the public education sector about $400 million, which might sound little in the U.S., but in Chile would be the equivalent to $4 billion of extra funding. We have achieved far more importance to something that was completely neglected, which was preschool education. That's also our job, and are proud of it. And also, this is a paradox. We've been able to stop in Parliament laws that would enhance segregation in Chile. You have to understand that the people who is in government now is not the sons of the people who work with Pinochet, but the same ones. It's the same guys with name and last name, okay? Not their children. And so they have been trying to push laws which go even further into segregation, okay? And we've been, and I'm proud to say that we've been able to stop those laws in the track in Congress. So we're proud.
Well, it sounds like you've had quite a bit of success then, the extra funding, the raised profile, some of the things that you've been able to stop, and some of those things you've been able to start. And all of this from a social movement that you created about 4 years ago. What are some of the methods that you're using to not only create your movement, but to get the word out and to raise the profile of this issue?
Yeah, that's something that we've been having to construct while we're going. I mean,
so you're learning while you're doing.
We are learning by doing, right. But I would say that there are two or three key elements. One of them is the passion of the people that work in our offices. Okay, they believe in this, and you know, when you have people with passion, things are different. Second, we've been able to combine passion with professionalism. We have a top head of the press area. We have people who make the community management of the social networks in internet. We have top guys studying the policy and producing projects for, you know, to take them to Parliament. We have another team working in the schools, in the poor schools, so that we know by heart what's going on there. It's not just a matter of policy. And one of our key strategies is what I call convergence. Once we have in our agenda for a month, let's say, the problem of teacher salaries, I'm just taking one of them, okay? Well, that month, Twitter is on salaries, Facebook is on salaries, our website is on salaries, our press releases are on teacher salary, our presentations in Congress are on teacher salary. So we attack the issue from many communicational points. We do lobby on salaries. So, and that way of tightening the screws has worked very well for us.
So you're coming from every angle, but it sounds like social media is one of your main weapons that you're using, if you will, the main weapons
we
in your arsenal.
We were born as a website, actually.
So you're a digital movement from the very beginning.
Well, yeah, we were born in the net. Now we've expanded to press, to lobby in Congress, but initially we were born.
You were born as a social media
adhering
movement.
Adhering to a manifesto in the net, okay? So the professional management of the community, management of internet is one of our specialties, let's say.
But now, are you getting people out in the streets? I mean, are you organizing people in that respect?
We are not the type of movement that goes out with sticks in the streets. But we dialogue with the students who are in the streets. We dialogue with the Communist Party. We dialogue with the extreme right. We dialogue with the experts in education. We've been able – that's another source of our influence, that everyone recognizes in us someone who they can talk with. And they all recognize, be they in agreement or not with us, that we speak with the truth, that when we show data, the data are real, that we are not twisting the data, you know, to push some argument. And so by being professional and serious, we've been able to, you know, gain the trust of the teachers' union and the students and everyone, and they all recognize in us that we're speaking our truth.
And certainly passion doesn't hurt.
Yes.
Well, Mario Weisbuch, thank you so much for being with us on Worldviews today. Very interesting story you have to tell about education in Chile. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Mario Weisbuch, the founder of the Chilean NGO Educación 2020. If you missed any part of this program or our earlier discussion about Syria, you can find audio, transcripts, and recaps on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a collaborative partnership between OU's College of International Studies and KGOU Radio. Mackenzie Samus prepared the research for this interview, and the program is produced by Brian Hardzinski. For Rebecca Cruz and Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Grelott.